You're tuned to 1520 WCHE Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will offer reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Avid Reader, brought to you by my bookstore, my independent bookstore, Wellington Square Bookshop, here in Westchester, Pennsylvania. So today we're going to be interviewing Emma Hooper, whose new book, which actually hasn't been released yet, it's a great book. It's called Etta and Otto and Russell and James. And we'll talk a little bit about the title later, too. But Emma was raised in Canada, in Alberta, and she's also a musician. And music, I think, informs her literature to a great extent. We can talk about that as well. So she lives in the UK, where she received her doctorate in musico-literary studies at the University of East Anglia, and she currently lectures at Bath Spa University. Her musical performance is as a solo artist in her own group of herself called Waitress for the Bees. And you can look it up on YouTube, and you can go to her website, too, and listen to it. It's really cool. And she plays with a number of bands. She also played with Peter Gabriel. And so anyway, Etta and Otto and Russell and James, as close as I can say it and as concisely because I talk too much, is that sometimes the decisions we make in life make no sense. And then the ones that make no sense turn out to be the decisions that make more sense than anything else. And sometimes the things we think are real or not real at all, in the end, they're the most real things in our life completely. So with that, Emma, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Hi.
Hi. So before I go off and talk too much, like I said, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about the book?
Okay. Well, the book is kind of at a bare bones level about a woman named Etta who is starting to lose her memory a little bit. She's suffering from sort of the onset of dementia. And as that's happening, she's soaking up her husband's memories and kind of identity. and so she decides to combat that. She needs to kind of self-actualize by walking from her Saskatchewan Canadian prairie home, their farm, all the way to the Atlantic Ocean, about 2,000 miles away. So she just sets off one day and does that. And Otto's left to fend for himself and figure out what he should do next now that he's alone for the first time in 50-odd years.
It's interesting because you seldom see books where the title is essentially the protagonist. So it's Etta and Otto and Russell and James, when the book theoretically could have been called something like, I don't know, Return to the Sea or Final Decisions, just like Gone with the Wind or The Stranger or The Trial or Fahrenheit 451 would be called. What made you decide in the title, other than there's a lot of double letters, what made you decide that you were going to call the book the people who were in it?
I had a few different names I was looking at, a few different titles I was considering. And Etta and Otto and Russell and James won because of what you mentioned earlier about my kind of musical identity on the side, where it's just a really lovely musical flowing phrase. The kind of da 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 is really nice. I really liked that, and I think that we relate to that more than we realize as readers. I think we pick up on these nice little rhythms. When you're kids, you find a lot in kids' nursery rhymes and nonsense rhymes, where what doesn't even have to mean anything. If it's got a good rhythm, it sticks with you. So I thought, yeah, that's not only does it, you know, tell you the names of the people in the book, it also has a really catchy rhythm. So that's why I went with that one.
Yeah, and it's interesting. As I said, I think the musical, it's almost like musical notation through the book. Some people look at a book where they know there's going to be alternate chapters that have different characters, and they go, oh, no, this is going to be hard to read. But in this case, those alternate chapters are seamless, and you find yourself following, and I guess I can use the word literally because you are following, you follow the characters as they move through space and time, and pretty much that's what music is about, I guess. Right?
Yeah, it is. It's sort of tempo is what it's about. Yeah, moving through time, a forward motion, and that's why there's a lot of white space in the book. I'm sure you noticed as well.
Yeah.
And that's kind of equally important to the pacing of the book, to the tempo as you read. There are some places where I was like, okay, we need to have a little break now before we get to the next bit. And so that's why you'll have a three-quarters of a page that's just white.
Yeah, and as we get towards, without giving anything away, as we get towards the conclusion, the pace is completely different. And, you know, you find yourself as a reader, I don't know, involved in that pacing. You know how your thumb and your forefinger are turning the page, and you can almost, it's almost as if you have your own baton and you're turning the page, because you see things are happening so quickly. And I guess that's why I read an interview that you had where you talked about how your publishers weren't concerned with the ending, but they were perhaps as people because, and I'm not really giving anything away here because you've talked about it, the ending is, as you said, the author is absent. And I like books rather than being tied up in a box with a ribbon. I like books where you just say, okay, it's up to you now, and that's what you do.
Yeah, I really, I remember when I was an undergrad and I learned about the death of the author, which is a sort of theory that Roland Barthes, a linguist, philosophist, came up with. When I learned about this theory, I kind of had my mind expanded in whole new ways. The idea that there's not one right answer for, you know, the poem you're reading doesn't have the one right meaning, or the book or whatever else, but the author is dead. It's up to the reader to construct the meaning. I mean, that really affects how I write. I really wanted to engage the reader in that way so that when they get to the end, they're deciding what happens, basically.
Yeah, I think the book means what the kind of people are who are reading it. I mean, if you're an optimist, if you're a fatalist, if you're pragmatic, if you're a romantic, you're going to come to different conclusions. So the type of person you are, I think, dictates to a certain extent what the book means.
Yeah, exactly.
And yeah, and what's really funny is because with correspondence in the book and with the melding of characters at times, the characters themselves don't know what life they're living in. And
yeah, it's true. Yeah, I kind of wanted to mirror that thing that's happening with the characters, between the characters and between the author and the reader. Kind of, who's in charge here?
Yeah, and again, without giving anything away, the one scene in the hospital room, I was like, oh, my God. What am I supposed to do with this? You know, it's like...
Yeah.
And it wasn't until... I don't want to give anything away. It was until the clothes entered. I'm thinking, okay, the clothes. Okay, now I get it.
just the little clues, tiny clues of reality.
Which is like Owen. Like, when Owen appears, when Otto is stationed overseas, I'm thinking, Owen. Oh, yeah, I remember Owen. And then when the one soldier says, you know, he's somebody I might want to, you know, stay a little bit away from, I'm thinking to myself, what does that mean? And then you as the reader kind of like piece together clues, but you're still not exactly sure. I think you did that really well.
No, yeah, thank you. It's interesting. Yeah, some people have put together, and it's very much depending on where those people come from in their own lives, have kind of put together the Owen puzzle right away. It's not even a puzzle for them. It's just like, oh, you know, this is who he is. And other people's, including some people, you know, I work with on the book, just didn't get it at all, and then were a little bit shocked at certain points.
Well, in retrospect, when Owen was teaching Otto how to read, there was a slight, you know, anyway, okay, and we'll do that.
It's hard not to get anything away.
I know. You're very difficult to interview.
I'm sorry. The thing I love, I mean, Owen is the character who didn't get to be in the title, and he should be. He shouldn't be, because that's the whole point. The whole point is that he wants to be in the title, and he's not allowed, and that's kind of because who he is kind of not allowed at that stage of history. it makes sense that he's a step back from comprehension as well.
It's very interesting because it's a love story in so many ways, and there are scenes that verge on, I don't know, that verge on sex, that verge on describing sex, but they do it in such a, I don't know what's the word, gentlemanly like way. I think there's, there's one word that might be considered, I don't know, prurient. One word in the entire book, and it's given in a certain situation that's painful for everybody, I guess. But you handle that very well too, and what you went the way you handle it, it's clear that there are two very strong loves involved here, and they compete.
Yeah, I mean,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
It's really tricky. I think all authors write romance and sex with the kind of bad sex awards in the back of their mind.
Yep.
And so you're thinking, you know, on the one hand, I guess it's kind of an honor to get one, but you don't really want to get one of those. But it's really hard to write that without ending up on one side of ridiculous. And so that's where the gentlemanliness comes from. But also because it is such a subjective thing, I think that's the reason why people find it hard to write about. It's kind of ridiculous in the same way that porn is kind of ridiculous. You know, it can be good or bad, but it's always something subjective that you're kind of trying to objectively watch voyeuristically. And so finding a way to do that is a bit of a trick.
Well, it's like when Otto comes home for that 6 days and then he goes back, and that letter he writes to Etta after that, that contains exactly what we're talking about, but without using any words that would offend anyone or even be close to describing any particular act. You know, he says, it's harder and easier to be here now, you know?
Mm. Yeah, and I guess that's the other reason is, like you say, without offending anyone. I've got a lot of students who I want to be able to read the book, so...
Yeah.
The last thing I wanted was for parents to say, oh, no, you can't read that book.
Yeah, I had interviewed one author who wrote a highly charged book that had lots of sexual situations, and she was a teacher, too, and she said the first day back she was so embarrassed and she blushed. She didn't like the idea that her students had read the things that she had written, and I can see that.
Yeah, it's kind of a division of your life.
So how come you think that neither... Ada nor Etta at the same time were becoming famous in a way and didn't even realize that? There was nothing in their heads that gave them the capability of realizing that they could be considered, I don't know.
It's just so outside of kind of what they would ever want or expect, because it just doesn't make sense coming from where they come from. This, you know, very simple farm living, rural living, the idea that people would be interested in your life just to be interested, not because you could, I don't know, give them a chicken or something, is just totally foreign to them. Yeah, so they do both find it really kind of off-putting and a little bit untrustworthy that people are interested in them for no obvious gain to themselves.
Yes.
It's just off their radar.
Yeah, sometimes Etta tries to run around it, and I don't think Otto even knew there were people driving by until the art gallery owner said, hey, look at, you don't think you're, and then he's looking and goes, oh, for me? And then when at the end, the little girl, what's her name, Cassia. When she says, well, you know, what she says, and he goes, yeah, okay, sure, no big deal. As opposed to being in an art gallery. And, and also the concept of papier-mâché and what it really means and what it stands for. And it's the same kind of gnomon that informs the book, that there are these real things, and they're real to him, as his guinea pig oats is real to him, But just like the book, you know, you're not really sure where that's coming from.
Yeah, and they're very temporary as well. Paper mache is, I mean, it's just flour and water in a newspaper, isn't it? It'll, like the gallery owner says, it'll melt the first time it rains. And
yeah, and she's more worried about it than he is.
Yeah, he doesn't care because he's just making it to make, and then whether or not everybody else gets a chance to see it is beside the point. Except he does want Etta and Russell Taylor to see it as their gift. But
well, it's like writing letters that you don't send. You know, they're just as meaningful.
Exactly. Well, I guess I'll give one small thing away. He does do that too. He writes these letters that he doesn't send.
No, I gave it away first.
Okay, yeah, you did.
Sorry, I don't know what I don't know what I can say. We could talk about other stuff.
just not talk about the book.
Well, it's now I'm scared. You know what's really funny? I will say this, and this I can't talk about really, but my favorite character in the book is James.
Yeah, I really like James as well. Like, as a individual, I like him beyond the concept of him. I think just he's very pragmatic. He just kind of is, because of the objectivity he has to Etta and kind of everything, you know, about her, he's able to kind of speak these truths, like, fire is dangerous, what are you doing playing with it? And you know, I'm only dangerous when I'm hungry, and that kind of thing. So I think he's very likable in his honesty.
Yeah, it's like if this was made into a movie, which probably will be, and the only, I can't say this, that character, James, if he would have to be portrayed in a certain fashion.
Would be. The casting would be trickier for James.
But I was thinking the voice would be someone like a really nice Woody Harrelson or a really nice Jeff Bridges. You know, someone who has that character, not disturbed by anything. You know, you go over here, I'll swim through, meet you on the other side, I'll know you by your smell, that kind of thing. And it's like he's just, there's this underlying kindness that's based on just, you know, this is life, this is the way we go forward, and I'm going with you, I'll take care of you, like that.
Yeah, it's simple. And I guess that's sort of the personality of Etta and Otto as well, but they can't help but be slightly more complicated just based on the fact of who they are.
Well, it's like the first page. It's like what marriage allows, what type of love allows you to let somebody go without running out the door screaming, come back, you know, please don't do this, you know, it'll work out, whatever. And instead it's just, yep, okay, take care, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think, well, there's lots of sort of gender role stuff at play in the book. And I was kind of trying to gently and subtly push against as many of them as I could. And that's a big one, is lots of people have said, like, well, and Russell says in the book, doesn't he, you know, some husband, you're not protecting her.
Yeah.
And that's, she doesn't need protection. He didn't need her protection when he went over, and she doesn't need his. They're serving a different purpose for each other, and I think it's a beautiful and important purpose, but it's not necessarily to chase them down and hold them in.
It's almost as if she's traveling to find him. And
yeah, it is. She's traveling to kind of distinguish herself from him, and in that way she finds both herself and him.
And that's the way you write it, and you like to keep the reader on his or her toes, and you said that in the interview too, which is why you have to read which I like about books, is you read the paragraph over a second time, or you flip the pages backwards to see, oh, okay. And I think that's very important for a reader and for the book, don't you?
Yeah, definitely. To kind of go back and put it all together a bit more slowly, definitely.
What about their ages, why did you decide they would be as old, as elderly as they are? What that must have been part of the seed of the germ of the book.
It was. I guess, well, there's kind of two answers to that question. The first answer is that these characters are loosely, like very loosely, based on my maternal grandparents. So they're based on my mom's mom and dad, who were old the whole time I knew them. And so oldness was, you know, a very basic trait. My grandfather did go over in the war, and his hair did turn white, and he was in a family of 15 kids, and my grandmother taught in the one-room schoolhouse and all of that. So that was something I took from life in a way. So I wanted them to be old to kind of reflect that mirroring. But secondly, they needed to be old because I wanted there to be a big gap in the middle of the book. Well, in the middle of sort of the perceived timeline of the book, where you have them meeting, the sort of, you know, beginning of the story, and then you have the end of the story, and the whole middle is left blank for you to fill in as you like, basically. There's very little that I that I give you between the ages of 22, basically,
I know,
and 82.
I know.
So that was intentional. I wanted to leave that space. The book is a lot. There's a lot about space in the book, whether it's white space on the page or the wide open prairies, or, you know, the physical distancing of people one from the other, and that's another chunk of space I wanted to have in there.
It's funny because part of me was like the part of me that sometimes think I own a bookshop. Oh, I'm just a shopkeeper, like, you know, and I denigrate myself for that. I mean, I do other things, but it's almost like, you know, and then I realize, no, I'm creating something very special. It's not about money. It's not about any of those things. It's not about ego. It's about a little girl sitting in a chair in the back of my bookstore reading Moby Dick. And the thing I thought about first, the knee-jerk response was, why didn't these people do anything with their lives? And, you know, they didn't become multimillionaires. They didn't invent anything. They didn't have fancy jobs. They picked thistles and dandelions. And they went and they had difficulty learning to write. And, you know, and then I said, no, that's not it. They had love. They were happy. They enjoyed the little things in life, like making food and, you know, Etta's recipe cards and things like that. So I had to step back and say, you know what, this is okay to live a life like this.
Yeah, exactly. It's, that whole missing bit isn't unimportant or isn't, yeah, not satisfying to them. It's just life. It's just their life. And I find there's a lot of books. I kind of got really into this when I was like 15 and then got really uninto it when I was like 18. All the kind of misery books where it's like every page is something else, somebody else committing suicide or, you know, horrible happening. And there's definitely horrible things that happen in the book and nice things that happen, but it doesn't have to be constant throughout an entire lifetime. There are definitely just long spells of existing that we do and that are lovely.
Yeah, there's a lot that happens without anything happening at all.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a lot of walking.
A lot of walking. And walking is kind of the perfect metaphor because walking is taking, you know, almost negligible length steps towards a long, long, large goal. And that's what she's doing, nothing out of the ordinary, just taking one step and then another one. And in the end, it builds up to a great journey.
So I don't know what image of you have in your mind of Etta, but the reason I always thought Etta was really pretty was because mm-hmm. of the big smile she gave in the schoolhouse. And when she's walking and she's old and the wisps of her hair were floating backwards, and those two things, and her dress when she went dancing. Those three things. Sounds like the Spanish Inquisition. Those three things made me feel like she was really pretty. Was she pretty?
That's a good question. I shy away from too much physical description. Like, I don't think I anywhere say what color her eyes were or what color her hair even is. And oh, no, I do say it's just normal, like a cowpat. I do say that.
That was very nice.
Yeah. I have a friend who described her hair that way. And I was like, oh, that's a sad way to think about your head. But in general, I like everything else. It's not just me being lazy. I like to leave a lot of that up to the reader again, so that I want her to be beautiful, but I want her to be beautiful in whatever way kind of falls into your imagining. So she's definitely a lovely, warm person. But I mean, she's not necessarily Claudia Schiffer, or any kind of bombshell like that. She's just beautiful as you construct her.
Well, when they make it a movie, you're going to have to figure it out, or they won't let you
figure it out. Yeah, I know. I know. The problem is, when they make it a movie, I just want all the people from the Road to Avonlea series. I don't know if you had that in the States. Did you have that?
No, we don't have it in this.
Okay, that's like a...
All we have is down.
Small town Canadiana TV show. they've all passed away. It's like Little House on the Prairie. You had that show.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, so you wanted to be like Michael Landon. So Otto would kind of look like Michael Landon, maybe, because he's got to be more.
Yeah, if Michael Landon was still alive today, he'd be about old enough.
Right, that's right.
To be Otto, but.
Oh, then you could stick Harrison Ford in there, maybe as Russell. I don't know; he's too tall.
Yeah, it is a tough call. I'll worry about it when the time comes.
No, it's not going to be Bradley Cooper though. Although, you know, he can do stuff. Yeah, you know, he's doing The Elephant Man on Broadway now, and he's not using any makeup or prosthetic devices, and. He's still supposed to.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah, and it's supposed to be really, really good.
Well, okay. He's an option. I'll put him on the list.
The other thing was, you know, I've interviewed Chris Klieb a couple of times, and it was really nice to get the blurb on the front cover from him, because I really have a lot of faith in him, and I understand from his writing is why he would think this, as he said, just one word, wonderful, with two exclamation points. One exclamation point, sorry.
Yeah, all right, it's enough.
But, yeah, he was a pleasure to interview. And, you know, after, you know, he couldn't issue Incendiary because he had written it right at the time of 9/11. But then when it was released afterwards, and again, it was an epistolary novel, too, just one letter to Osama bin Laden. But, yeah, I can see why he liked it. He would like the pacing of it, and he likes the way the characters were formed, I think.
Yeah, and I think the sort of careful crafting, although, I mean, it's not the same at all, but I think it's something that kind of works with the both of us.
So what is it about the sea that always, and I know this is a question that's kind of hackneyed, but what is it about the sea that draws everyone to it? I mean, it always does. It draws me to it. I mean, I know we came from there, and I understand all that, but what do you think?
It's like so you know, like the night sky that we look up at and we're like, oh my gosh, that's so big and crazy and far away. I think the sea is like that, but in real life, even though the night sky is also in real life, the sea is we can touch it. We can like get into it. It's like being able to get into outer space, just kind of whenever we want. And it's just massive, and it's at the same time the giver and the taker of life, right? Water is basic, is elemental to us, and it can also, you know, snuff us out super quickly. So I think it's just so big, like the night sky, but within our grasp, we can be there with it, even if we can't fully understand it or even see it all at once.
Yeah, no, it's funny. You're talking about the night sky, and what I realize a lot lately is that, especially with walking along the street and seeing everybody with iPhones talking on them or headphones in their ears, at night no one really looks up anymore. No one looks up. And
yeah.
My daughter looks up. 'Cause,
oh, that's good. Is she too young to have an iPhone?
Well, no. She knows that she would lose it, so she hasn't even asked for it. She loses everything. I said, you would lose your head if it wasn't attached to your neck. She goes, no, because then I wouldn't be able to walk because my head couldn't tell me, so no, I wouldn't lose my head.
Yeah, that's good. She's got good logic going on there. That's good. Yeah, it is true. And I mean, in cities where, you know, so many of us live now, you can't see as much of the night sky.
Right, not at all. In fact, I interviewed a guy who wrote about darkness and the absence of it, and he tried to find the 10 most dark places in the world. It was a fascinating book because, like, in New York or even out in the suburbs, there's just too much light.
All the time. I imagine he probably went underground. That's where I imagined it being the darkest.
Yes, but he wanted to see the night sky. But, yeah, I was in a cave once where the guide said, all right, everyone turn their lanterns off. And it was the darkest I had ever seen. Have you been in one of those situations where it's so dark it's beyond being blind?
Yeah, it's crazy. There's some amazing caves near where I live that when I was young and stupid, we used to just like go in them, and there's like 90 miles of them.
Heaps.
And one of my friends got lost, and it became very dark as soon as, you know, your friend's lost down there.
It's very scary, and you begin to panic really quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just a really foreign experience. You're not used to it. There's always a little bit of shadow. You can make outlines and stuff. When there's none of that, it totally throws you off.
That was the other thing. I just realized no one ever panics in the book, except Ada panics one time, and she's panicking vicariously for something that happened to Otto. And it happened to Otto, and he wasn't that upset about it. And then his actions after that, some people would say those were not the best actions to take also. And then, oh, God, never mind. I mean, no one's read that. You know, anyone who's listening to this has my listeners hate me because I'm talking to you about the book because I like the book, but it's not even published yet, you know?
Yeah. It's going to be out really soon, though. Really soon.
Yeah, it'll be a week.
And it's out in Bulgarian, so if they really want to know.
Oh, yeah, you know, and you go to Publishers Weekly online, and then there's this big story about the auction for your book and six publishing houses, and then all these preamps, none of which I understand any of. But it's like, wow, she must be really great. That was before I read the book.
Well, I mean, obviously I'm really great, but the publishing world is a very mysterious machine. I have equally great friends who had nothing like that happen to them. It's just I've only just begun to learn about what all those words mean. And they're fascinating. It's very, especially coming from the music side of things, because I've been a freelance musician for most of my adult life. And it's a very different industry. It's kind of, there's a lot of networking, but there's a lot of sort of basement recording stuff happening now, right?
Yeah.
So much. I actually had a recording session today that was in the producer's bedroom. and, you know, it was a proper professional. We got paid and everything, and it's going to be on a real album. But that's how so much is done, and it's not that way with literature. Not the big publishing houses anyways.
No, and that's why for them it's so scary, because so many things are written only for the internet, because the people who write them are only interested in writing them, and then all of a sudden something takes off, without there being a middleman of sorts. And it's the whole definitely, to be again hackneyed, it's definitely a paradigm shift. I was thinking about water, and you know, even though Ada hasn't reached the water, there's a lot of water in the book, you know? She loves putting her feet in the water, and she loves washing herself, and she loves the streams and things like that. She loves water throughout the book before she reaches the water.
Yeah, that's true. And, yeah, she has to cross sort of the first obstacle she comes to is this long lake. And I think it's called Long Lake, which is a real lake in Saskatchewan. There is a lot of water in the book before she gets to the water, and I think it's that thing where the absence of something makes it so much more potent. So the fact that she's from such a dry place, they're from such a dry place where water is so precious, means that she really notices it when it's around, and she probably thinks about it more than an average person would for that reason. Because, yeah, she's had whole, you know, childhood years where it hasn't rained once, and they've got grass is just crumbling by being frozen, but not frozen with frost, because there's no moisture in the air.
even the flowers that, you know, Otto uses as a soporific, you know, they're gone. He has to put a note up on the bulletin board in order to find any of them.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's not like England where kind of everything will grow everywhere.
It's snowing
all
here.
The time.
It's snowing here right now.
Oh, is it? It's
yeah.
definitely not snowing here. It's lovely. I went for a run this morning in shorts and a t-shirt. It's not snowing.
Really?
Yeah. It's always the same. It's always the same temperature in England, pretty much.
Yeah, it's like,
pretty much between like, oh, I don't know Fahrenheit. I don't know your crazy system. It's between like 5 and 15 Celsius here, year round, basically.
It's times 9/5 plus 32.
Okay. There you go.
Oh, well, now I forgot what I was going to ask. It was a good question, too.
Sorry, I tangented.
Went off. Okay.
We were talking about water.
No, I was thinking that everybody in the book is seeking something, even if it's Owen. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, but we talked a little bit before about, I'm going to mispronounce it, Briony. Mm-hmm. You told me exactly how it is. There's two reporters that follow Etta when she becomes really popular, kind of like in a Forrest Gumpy way. And, mm-hmm. One of them is uncertain about her life. You can tell right away that she wants to come, and then she does. But she's searching for something that's completely different, and it takes her a long time to even admit it to herself, and then to commit to doing it. And that was a really interesting side story, wasn't it?
Yeah, I really do think. I think of Briony as a separate little side story, like you say. This little character who, it has no story, and that's why she's been a reporter all her life. It's because she tells other people's stories. She kind of uses surrogate stories her whole life, and that's because the one story that she has is just a little bit too painful for her to even tell herself until she finally owns up to it with Etta.
And the most painful thing to me about it was he was a really nice guy. And we were talking about astronomy just a minute ago.
Yeah, just seeing the stars.
There's something. Yeah, he was a
He was a nice guy.
Yeah.
And
so
she doesn't know how he's not a nice guy. And I think that's the real tragedy, is that it's not that, I'm just going to give something else away. It's not that her brother
has
ended up. I'm just going to say it like that. Is that she, in her mind, she doesn't know why. It's not that he's done that. It's just that he's still this good person, and she has to sort of fess up
to
terms with the fact that he's not. Sorry, go ahead.
No, sorry. I'm always interrupting. I shouldn't do that. You're supposed to be talking about me.
No,
I was just thinking how she doesn't even find out except through her girlfriend. And then we're all wondering, what the heck did he... How? What did he, you know? And she finally decides it's not the sea, but it's going to the sea to find out. And mm-hmm. it takes an enormous amount of courage on her part to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I like that she has to abandon Etta for that to happen as well. That's really hard for her. She sort of finds Etta as this great surrogate story that she can... really dig into, but at the same time it's just as a real surrogate, because she's going to actually use that as a stepping stone off to her own one.
Well, it's like Russell looking for deer and then Otto finding them and then like papier-mâché, but then Russell has to go after, but then he goes off on his own way too, you know? It's like,
exactly, yeah. It's sort of people using other, you know, vicarious adventures as an excuse not to have their own. When really, Etta's very much about, like, it's tied in with the whole fame thing. They don't want to be famous. They want people to go off and make their own papier-mâché animals, stop looking at mine, kind of thing. It's like professional sports. I find professional sports very strange. I'd much rather just go and play soccer than watch people play soccer.
Well, it's been like that, too. I turn on the TV and there's, like, football on or golf or even frisbee. I just turn off the TV and I go out and do it because it's just there's something in me that just makes me want to get up and do it.
And exactly. It makes me jealous.
Yes. Yeah. That is funny. Yeah, so they all go off on their own, but at the same time, they're tied together inextricably forever, and literally, no, not literally, that's wrong, I always use that. They they are together forever in a way, and always will be, and you know, when he says it's just this loop, it's just this loop that keeps looping. That's pretty much what the universe is, you know?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, the Douglas Hofstadter, who wrote Gedalish or Bach, Eternal Golden Braid, he talks about that. He talks, I am a strange loop. That's one of his premises. Have you read all the...
Yeah, and that's it.
Go ahead.
There's sort of the idea of free will mixed in with... And that, again, comes back to the author-reader relationship. There's this free will where the reader's getting to make decisions, but you are tied into this predestined thing to some extent. That's your loop.
Yeah, and then, you know, you can go... It's recursive because it's your universe. It's not my universe. You gave me a universe to live in for a while. And then you said, okay, sorry, I got to go.
And yeah. you take it from here.
Yeah. Which is really cool. Have you read All the Light We Cannot See?
No, it's on. I have a spreadsheet, a Google spreadsheet of books.
Oh, so you're like super organized like that?
I think it's because I'm super disorganized, and it's if I don't write something down, usually the Google spreadsheet, then it'll just be gone forever. I'll never ever remember it. It's because I have like too many jobs. I just have to like put everything in its little place, and then I'll know where to find it later. And that's in my Google spreadsheet, but I haven't read it yet.
Maybe I'll make that one of my New Year's resolutions, because I'm horrible that way. I forget everything. I forget where I'm supposed to be. It's horrible.
It's not. It's kind of liberating. I think.
Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah. One day when I'm not juggling the music and the academic and the writing, I will. I'll just forget stuff all the time. It'll be great.
I just saw somebody's calendar, and she had a section for preparing to sleep and sleep.
Oh my god.
And
wow.
And wake.
I don't have that.
And clean this room.
What do you do in the preparing to sleep? Is that like just when you're lying in bed?
I guess it's like, you know, you're just winding down, and I don't know. I asked her. I said she was going to come see me, and I said, "But what if you're preparing to sleep?"
Yeah.
Do you have the time?
I love the idea of scheduling in the, like, 7 minutes it takes to fall asleep.
I don't even sleep. I don't know how you prepare for sleep. I read your book is what I do, and I fall asleep with the book on my chest. That's how I read it.
Yeah. That's the best way to do it. That's fair.
Yeah. It's tough, though, because I have to get up at 5:30 in the morning and take the kids to the bus, which, you know. So.
Yeah. In the dark. That's
Yeah, I know. That's the worst part.
That would be the worst part, yeah. So, yeah, the nice thing about being, well, all of my jobs mean that I get to sleep until at least 9, which is nice.
Yeah, that is nice. I used to be able to do that. But, okay. Can you think of anything else? I can't think of anything else.
I think we've done a really good job of mostly not doing any spoilers, because
I've never... I've never interviewed anyone where I can talk so little about the book. And everything I've said, like I said, the listener can't possibly understand what the heck we're talking about.
Yeah. It's funny, though, because it's not like a thriller or a crime novel or anything like that. It's not, you know, full of all these little clues in that way. They're just quiet, pivotal plot moments.
Well, that's why you should read. You should put that. That should be your first book, All the Light We Cannot See. Just forget your Google spreadsheet. Just
oh yeah, okay.
Pick that up and read it, because what?
Well, the Google spreadsheet, it doesn't go in order. It's just I do a random sampling, so it's fine.
Well, at least that's something.
Yeah.
So yeah, you should read that, because what happens? It's two stories, two people. You know, this one kid is German and he's a Nazi. He doesn't want to be a Nazi. He has all this potential to be everything. And he's precluded from it. And the girl is this wonderful girl. And this is all in the reviews. And she's blind. And everyone calls her a hero, like they do with Etta. And she says, I don't understand what they're saying, just like Etta. I wake up in the morning and I live my life. which is mm-hmm. what everyone does, and she doesn't understand why, just like Otto wouldn't understand about the papier-mâché, why they... But the cool thing about the book is, like Etta pulls the reporter to make this decision. She wouldn't have made a decision without Etta.
Mm-hmm.
She drags along people who make decisions because of her. And with James, like her Virgil, descending into hell, you know?
And, oh, yeah.
And so at the end of the book, everything kind of comes together, and you realize how one person, unbeknownst to him and not even trying, can connect all these lives together and can change, you know, so many people's lives, you know, even if
does, like, how much that actually happens in real life.
Yeah, I know. And a lot of it is...
Okay, that's a pretty good pitch.
Yeah.
I'll order that one. That's fair.
Yeah, it's... If you don't like it, I will pay you for it.
Oh, wow. Okay, in pounds.
Pounds are not worth what they used to be.
Pounds are worth a lot. Fair.
But,
Canadian dollars.
Yeah, compared to... Oh, yeah, that's true. And compared to euros right now. And Greece, oh, gosh.
Yeah, that too.
Well, anyway, so, yeah, it was really, really fun interviewing you about this. It's a great book. We'll definitely have it on our front table at the bookstore. And if you ever get to the States and you want it to come to the bookstore and do a signing or even Skype in, we'll probably have it as a book club when it comes out in paperback. So, yeah, that would be wonderful.
Oh, great. Yeah, I am planning on my partner's from the States, so we go around. So, you know, I'll just show up one day.
Yeah, well, I looked at your tour information, and it's all over there.
Do you have that? I don't have that yet.
I think I do.
They sent me one or they sent me.
I should send you one.
That would be handy. Yeah, I'll put that in my Google Diary. That'd be good.
Okay, so anyway, yeah, it was a pleasure. So thank you so much talking to us. Okay.
Thank you for talking to me. And good luck with your bookshop and everything.
Oh, thank you. Emma Hooper, Etta and Otto and Russell and James. An incredible book. She's a lovely, lovely person. And as I said, go to YouTube and listen to some of her music, which is really cool and very different, just like this book is. And today, as I spoke to her, the book is not yet out. It'll be out January 20th. I didn't want to say it when I was talking to her, but it went to like this auction and she got an enormous advance. It's been translated into so many languages already. And I'm sure it'll be a movie, although, as she said, casting it will be extremely difficult. And you'll find out why when you read the book. So join us every week on The Avid Reader for what was this insightful and engaging discussions with some of the world's most compelling authors. As I've said before, bragging, you know, we've interviewed 3 of the last 4 Pulitzer Prize winners, 2 of the last 3 National Book Award winners. And our upcoming interviews include Christina Baker Klein and S.M. Hulse. So for a complete schedule, you can visit us at our website, wellingtonsquarebooks.com, or go to wchefifteentwenty.com, or you can anytime download or just listen to our podcast at iTunes or Podomatic or on our YouTube channel. So thanks as always for listening, and we will talk to you next week.
You've been listening to The Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.